Kalina, in due course of time, after millions and millions of years. Panchatvam, when everything illusory is annihilated. Iteshu,
all transformations.
Krishnasha, with everything within this cosmic manifestation. Lokeshu, all the planets, or everything that exists. Paleshu, maintainers like Lord Brahma. Cha, also. Sarvahetushu, all causative existences. Tamaha, great darkness. Tada,
then.
Asit, was. Gahanam, very dense. Gabiram,
very deep.
Yaha, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who? Tasha,
this dark situation.
Pade,
over and above.
Abhivirajate,
exists or shines.
Vibhu,
the Supreme.
So, translation. In due course of time, when all the causative and effective manifestations of the universe, including the planets and their directors and maintainers, are annihilated, there is a situation of dense darkness. Above this darkness, however, is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I take shelter of his lotus feet. So you can repeat, in due course of time,
in due course of time,
when all the causative and effective
manifestations of the universe,
including the planets,
and their directors and maintainers,
are annihilated,
there is a situation of dense darkness.
Above this darkness, however,
is the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
I take shelter of his lotus feet. So, purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. From the Vedic mantras, we understand that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is above everything. He is supreme above all the demigods, including Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva. He is the supreme controller when everything disappears by the influence of his energy. The cosmic situation is one of dense darkness. The Supreme Lord, however, is the sunshine, as confirmed in the Vedic mantras, Aditya Varnam Tamasa Parastat. In our daily experience, when we on earth are in the darkness of night, the sun is always luminous somewhere in the sky. Similarly, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Supreme Sun, always remains luminous, even when the entire cosmic manifestation is annihilated in due course of time. So, Kalena Panchatvam Miteshu Kachnasho Lokeshu Palishu Chasarvahitushu Tamastadasid Gohanam Gavirang Yathapare Vivarajate Vibohu. So, Om Gana Timiranda Shah Gananjana Shlakya Chaksur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurudeva Maha. So what is being presented here in this particular verse is something known as Sambandha Gyan. Sambandha Gyan is one of the three aspects of knowledge which we get in the Vedic literatures. There's Sambandha Abhideya and Prayojana. Sambandha Gyan means basically understanding the different tattvas. Tattva actually means categories. It doesn't, sometimes it's translated as truth, but actually means categories. Like we were discussing this in the Sunday class on the Bhagavad Gita, that there's five different categories in the Bhagavad Gita. Like the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you got to turn it up because it's not practically non-existent. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, time, karma, material energy, etc. So these are different tattvas or different categories. And it's interesting sometimes it's mentioned there's five different topics in the Bhagavad Gita, but actually we did this analysis that devotional service is the largest topic in the devotion in Bhagavad Gita. And of course, devotional service is not specifically one of the tattvas or category. It can be considered a category, but according to the acharyas, devotional service is more of a topic than a category. So just a little bit of information there, because we analyzed there's over 300 verses in the Gita that are dealing with devotional service. Wow, 300 out of 700, that's a pretty good number. And that's more than the categories such as time. Time has very few, and karma has very few. Of course, the material energy has quite a bit, so that people can understand how to deal with the material energy. So here, then we have Ishvara Tattva is being described under the guise of Sambandhagyan, that is knowledge of God, knowledge of the living entity, knowledge of the material world, the interactions. The word Sambandha actually means the relationships between all these different entities. So here we see the material world's relationship, or Krishna's relationship with the material world. So that's Sambandha. So what's very interesting about this particular verse is it's one of the main topics of the Srimad Bhagavatam. In fact, the first of the nutshell verses of the Srimad Bhagavatam exactly says the same thing. That before the creation, there was I, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. During the creation, there's I. And after the creation, there's I. The Supreme Personality of God. In other words, Krishna is transcendental to this creation. He's not, in the Brahma Samhita, it says something very similar in the first verse, Ishvara Parama Krishna, Satya Nanda Vigra. And then Anadir Adir Govinda Sarvakarana Karna. He's the cause of all causes. In other words, he's not caused, as Prabhupada translates here, when all the causative and effective manifestations of the universe are annihilated. So in other words, he's not caused by anything else, and he is causing everything else. So this is a very important topic to understand. Now, I'd like to actually do some application. How is this applied, or how can we apply that into our understanding of the material world? And how can we understand or apply this in relationship to our understanding of religion? So let's take Krishna's... what are you putting up there? Oh, you're putting it near the speaker. Just be careful it doesn't fall when they open up the... it's a mobile phone, expensive thing. So let's take Arjuna's question in the 17th chapter about faith. Arjuna asked the question, like if someone doesn't follow scripture, is his faith of the mode of in the mode of ignorance, or is it passion, or is it goodness? And Krishna answers in a very interesting way. He says, according to the modes that one is in, one develops a particular type of faith. In other words, if one is in the mode of ignorance, one develops a faith in the mode of ignorance. And of course, we find various descriptions, those in the mode of ignorance, they worship the ghosts and the spirits, and those in the mode of passion, they worship the demons like Hitler. Prabhupada even gives an example in the Gita how there was one man who made a lot of money for World War II, and he worshiped Hitler. This is actually quite interesting. I don't know if he put Hitler on his altar or whatever. In the same way, I think people who are into business and not into ecology may be worshiping a particular politician who will be taking office very soon, who should remain nameless anyway. Probably you don't look at the news, so you don't know who I'm talking about. It's interesting. I mean, it's actually quite interesting that people who are making some particular profit out of a particular political situation actually worship that politician. It's interesting.
I saw a video of Hindus worshiping, they're doing puja for Donald Trump.
You can't mention name. It's,
oh, sorry.
He whose name cannot be mentioned. Any of you have seen Harry Potter film, you know what I'm talking about. Anyway, so so actually, you know, they worship someone who they can make some money from. And that's, of course, the mode of passion and the mode of goodness. I mean, material goodness, they worship the demigods. We understand that. So apart from that, even when people worship God, let's say the Supreme Personality of Godhead, their understanding of God is tinged with their conditioning. And I'm going to give a practical example that hopefully I don't offend anybody. But in other words, it's tinged with their particular culture, their upbringing, and everything like that. Let's give the example of, well, Christianity, for example. That Christianity, the Muslim religion, and the Jewish religion, they're all called Abrahamic religions. You know, in other words, they all come from Abraham. The reason they're called Abrahamic religions is that you had Abraham, who was the original Prajapati. And he was married to a lady named Sarah. And Sarah was, and I've told the story before, but some of you haven't heard it. Sarah, it was predicted by God that Sarah would have so many children that, you know, would fill the whole universe, basically the stars in the sky. But she was too old to have children. So it was decided that Abraham would have a relationship with their servant girl. And he had a relationship, and she had a kid. And then Sarah, somehow or other, had a kid, even though she was 80 years old. And so Abraham rejected that one son who was born of the servant lady. And that son's name was Ishmael. Anyway, and he became the Prajapati, or the progenitor, or the forefather of all the Arabs and the Palestinians, which is interesting. And then he accepted the one, the Jacob, who was who became the Prajapati or progenitor of all the Jewish people. So anyway, so you basically have the same family. And you have, also if you look at the history, you'll see there's a lot of violence. Now people now talk about Muslim, but actually the Jewish people were extremely violent. Were extremely violent, and it's just part of the culture, you know, violence, because it's basically, the Middle East is not exactly the place for the most intellectual people on the planet. India has always been. India is very interesting. If you look at the history of India, there's always been religious freedom in India, intellectual activity, ability to criticize even the prime minister, president, or king. Just like you see Lord Ramchandra's time. There was a washerman criticizing Lord Ramchandra. It's not like nowadays, like not in certain countries, not America, of course. In certain countries, if you criticize the president or the prime minister or whatever, you go to jail. In Russia, there's a little problem like that. But in other countries, it's even a greater problem. And even someone threatened, who should remain nameless, that to stop this one humorous program about politicians called Saturday Night Live, they threatened to stop it, you know, because they were criticizing them. Anyway, so, or in America, of course, they stopped criticism by taking you to the courts and suing you. And then you lose everything, and obviously you can't fight against a whole army of lawyers. because it would cost you more money to fight. So it's better just to shut up. So in any case, India has this really interesting history where you have intellectualism and everything. In the Middle East, there's not that history. There's a history of desert people fighting each other and everything like that. And might makes right. And even in the Bible, you have statements when Moses and his gang left Egypt for the promised land, they were actually killed, every man, woman, and child on the way there. And, the Palestinians. And of course, the Christians did the same thing with the Crusades when they went through Europe and the Middle East on the way to the Holy Land. He killed even other Christians, and the statement they made was, "Let God sort it out." So you have this, amazing violence and everything like that. And of course, if you go back to Abraham and the Jewish religion, sacrifice in order to gain the favor of God. I'm leading up to something, so don't worry. In order to gain the favor of God, you had to sacrifice an animal. And, sometimes even God tested people by asking them to sacrifice their son. So there was this whole idea. And, of course, when the Lord Jesus Christ went to the temple in Jerusalem, he tried to stop that whole thing. He considered it horrible that people were sacrificing the lambs. And, of course, it became a money-making endeavor. He even turned over the money changers' tables. People were selling lambs or changing money. And just like now, even in India, you go outside any temple and they set up all these stores and you could buy garlands. Of course, they don't sell lambs for slaughter or anything, which is, it's actually more goodness. Business in the mode of goodness rather than business in the mode of ignorance, selling lambs. At least they're selling garlands still for the deities. Like we go to the Banka Bihari temple in Vrindavan, there's like so many garland sellers. And even our ISKCON temple outside of the front gate, there's so many garland sellers. So at least that's nice business. So anyway, Jesus Christ stopped that because he considered it horrendous. The whole idea is that you can please God by killing someone. I mean, God is transcendental. He doesn't need a sacrifice to be merciful. And then it became transformed in Christianity to that if you want, that God has actually even sacrificed his own son so that he could become free from sins. So you see, the point I'm making is that this whole scenario under certain modes of nature became part of the religious liturgy, part of the religious belief system, just because it was ingrained in the culture, even though it doesn't make any sense. I mean, does it make sense for, let's say if, of course, the general philosophy is, let's just go back a little bit. The general philosophy is that we are all sinful, we're all fallen, so therefore there has to be a sacrifice. And that sacrifice, in Christianity, that sacrifice is that God arranges for his son to be killed. I mean, does that make sense? I mean, if you think about it, let's say you're a parent and one of your sons is really bad. Let's say that's you. And your parents have another son who's really good, perfect. And so your father comes to you and says, "My dear son, you are really bad. But in order to rectify your being really bad, I'm going to kill my good son." Does that make sense? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. And that's not actually what Jesus Christ taught either. So, but the point I'm making is not to criticize, the so-called understanding of Christianity, but to actually show how a particular social culture influences people's understanding, or transforms an understanding of religion into something that's different than it actually was. Jesus Christ's teaching, it was, you have to actually look at his teaching, is love He had two teachings, actually, basically. Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and all thy might, and do unto others as you would have others do it to you. And of course, that's from the Bible originally. He said all these rules and regulations and the Jewish religion, which he was a member of, had so many different rituals. I mean, you talk about the rituals we have in Krishna consciousness, there were actually more rituals in the Jewish religion, because rituals get developed after some time. They don't actually start with the founder of a particular religion, but they come, it's sort of like as the generations proceed, then the religion accumulates more rituals. Does it? Everybody understand that? I mean, if you look at the founder of the religion, they definitely didn't institute too many rituals. I mean, like Krishna, for example, in the Bhagavad Gita, he doesn't give a lot of rituals. He says, you know, just always think of me, become my devotee, man mana, bhava mat bhakto, mat yaji mam namaskuru, mam vivashati sachate, patichate, priyosime. Become my devotee, think of me, offer your obeisances unto me. You know, fine, wow. And then next generation, more things added. Next generation, more things added. It's just like the typical thing. It's not that all rituals are unnecessary. I mean, sometimes we have acharyas who add different procedures and rituals, and those are actually useful to help us according to time, place, and circumstance. Like Prabhupada even said that certain rituals or certain practices are applicable in India, and they may not be applicable in the Western world. That's in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So one has to understand how to apply things according to time, place, and circumstance, and not be stuck in a certain mindset of something that worked before. So anyway, so the point is, I mean, getting back to this whole point of the verse, is that Krishna is transcendental. And we should understand the difference between Krishna's transcendental nature, Krishna's transcendental pastimes, and everything like that, and then the practical application in this world, and understand those things which are conditioned by the social situation or the cultural situation, and those things which are transcendental. And some of the things have to be accepted according to the social situation, just like Prabhupada instituted certain things in India. Let's give the example of how Prabhupada installed the deities in Krishna Balaram Mandir. That Prabhupada had all the ritualistic brahmanas do their thing to install the deities so the people would accept it as part of the preaching. And also the same thing occurred in Tirupati. We had the deity installation there of the Astasaki deities in the new temple of Tirupati. Then all the Ramanujacharya sadhus came and actually conducted the rituals so that we would be respected. But we have to be careful about not accepting all, you know, just letting things build up and build up to the point where we just become engaged in niyamagraha. You understand? Niyamagraha means to have all these different rituals and rules and regulations, and then we forget the purpose. And the original rule and regulation was to always remember Krishna and never forget Krishna. So even rituals, rules, and regulations that are useful, we have to understand how to apply them. What to speak of what we were talking about before, of rules, regulations, and understandings that may just come from the modes of nature, which is in the case of most religions that we see in the world today, especially the Abrahamic religions. So these are some of the points I wanted to make. Of course, Janma Karma Chame Divyam. I mean, this is also what's being talked about here. Krishna's transcendental to the his activities and appearance are transcendental. One who understands that, according to Krishna and the Gita, Chatvadayam Punarjanma Nati Mam Eti Sorjana. So this is a really important point. Understanding Krishna's appearance and activities, and separating them from some of the, you know, our habits, rituals, and things that we do. So anyway, I'm not going to go into further discussion of this because it can get a little bit more controversial, like if I start talking about how to apply Krishna consciousness in the Western world and understanding. I probably even said that understanding how to present Krishna consciousness, how to engage people in Krishna consciousness in the Western world. So, any questions or comments? Yes.
So, how do we differentiate what's transcendental and what's...
What's according to time, place, and circumstance? I mean, many things according to time, place, and circumstance are necessary. Are actually absolutely necessary. I mean, for example, let's give an example of things that are, that we think are actually transcendental or spiritual or even come from India that are just adjustments according to time, place, and circumstance. For example, many of the things we offer to the deities, many of the different types of food, I mean, let's give the example of halva, for example, which everyone loves until you get diabetes. So this is not something that was present 5,000 years ago. You know, so but it's become part of an ISKCON ritual, which is all right. We're not criticizing. It's part of an ISKCON, you know, what you do, you offer halva to the deities and things like that. But understanding it's not something that descends from the spiritual world. It's not something that's given in the Shastras. It's not something that Krishna ate. It's not mentioned. It's actually the word halva comes from the Middle East. So understanding that certain things we do are not eternal things. What is eternal is the chanting of the Lord's holy names, the Lord's pastimes, the service to the Vaishnavas. I mean, these are all on a different level than some of the things we do, or some of the ways we dress, or some of the ways we greet each other. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't accept those things. We accept those things understanding their place in Krishna consciousness, not trying to transcendentalize them. Otherwise, if we try to transcendentalize them, or think that they're transcendental, or they have to be applied in every time, place, and circumstance, we may find ourselves irrelevant in certain cultures. Especially in America, or, you know, maybe Western cultures, we may find ourselves incapable of spreading Krishna consciousness. So we have to keep... I mean, I'm making, of course, an indirect reference to our program here, where we're... cultivating Western people and bringing people to Krishna consciousness. Can't mention the word Krishna West in class. Anyways, because people are watching on the internet. Of course, I just mentioned it. That, you know, we adjust certain things to make people more comfortable and bring people to Krishna consciousness. And you have the essential items like the chanting, the prasadam, the bhagavatam. I mean, these are all essential eternal items. And... that is our business, to get people to chant, to get people to offer their food to Krishna, to get people to read the Srimad Bhagavatam, read the Bhagavad Gita, dedicate their life to Krishna consciousness and spreading this knowledge and spreading the practices of Krishna consciousness. Other things can be adjusted. Understand that many of these things come from certain cultures, just like I gave the example. Of course, we don't use the culture of killing animals, offering animals, especially we don't offer our children to get God's mercy. I mean, obviously we don't do that. That's obviously from a lower mode of nature. But what we do, we can take things from the mode of goodness and utilize them to spread Krishna consciousness. I mean, just like, you know, devotees may have a restaurant where they offer food in the mode of goodness to people, you know, Krishna conscious food. In the mode of goodness. It doesn't necessarily just have to be halal. I mean, for example, if you're going out and distributing prasadam on the street, what would be a better way, better thing to distribute, a glob jamun or a cookie? What do you think? A cookie, because people are going to be more readily able to accept it. Has a glob jamun had more spiritual potency than a cookie? I don't think so. Why would it have more spiritual? Where does Krishna say in the Gita that a glob jamun is actually better than a cookie?
So you have to be able to separate some of the culturally inculcated concepts that we have from the eternal tattvas, the eternal truths, the eternal practices of Krishna consciousness. So we got a lot of people watching. I'm sure I'll get in trouble for this class. So any other questions? We got 2.5 more minutes. Yes, go for it.
See what you're saying in reference to,
culturally
inculcated, paradigms in reference to Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And
well, that's obvious.
Yeah, I mean, in referencing God, but at the same time, I'm also thinking about there's so many examples of personalities in the Srimad Bhagavatam who were willing to sacrifice their life to save, like the one gentleman who was given a mantra, was told not say it to anybody, or else he would go to hell. But he's willing to.
No, he's willing to do that. But it's not that that's the willingness of a devotee. But God does not demand that.
No.
That's a different. It's a little bit different. Like Prabhupada sacrificed his life for spreading his health and everything for spreading Krishna consciousness. That's true. But it's not in order to become Krishna conscious. Someone has to be sacrificed. It's a little bit different.
I mean, I'm just curious.
No, it actually came from the Abrahamic system of actually killing an animal. That killing, the whole point was, I mean, of course, that came originally from India, where they had to sacrifice, Ashwamedha, Gomedha, that happened in a different yuga. And, of course, that animal was rejuvenated and got a human body and was elevated and everything like that. So that the whole culture that someone had to be sacrificed in order to get God's mercy, or that God had to sacrifice, but that's the mood of a pure devotee, is that I'm willing to sacrifice everything. But it's not that a pure devotee says, I'm willing to cut my throat. It's not that a pure devotee is the lamb that's put down in the sacrifice, where you slit its throat so that you can be liberated. The mood is, we're willing to sacrifice, we're willing to do what's necessary, we're willing to give up all of our happiness to help others. But not that God needs that. Because God is transcendental. Why does he need to do anything to achieve anything? He's out to karma. He's swarat. He's independent. Why does he need to do anything? He can liberate the whole world if he wants. He doesn't need to kill his son to liberate us. I mean, that means that God is not God. If he needs to do something, he's not the cause of all causes. If he needs to do something to accomplish something else, he doesn't. That means he there's a cause to God, or a cause to God's mercy, but mercy is causeless. Okay, on that happy note. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. All glorious to Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Okay, now we'll see the deities. Jai Radha Gulukananda ki jai.